wild, especially the socially conscious Adlers, but they could hardly object to such a public-spirited gesture. And what if Danny Hansford's mother won her $10 million lawsuit against him? Would the house not fall into her hands? "Danny's mother will never live in Mercer House," Williams declared, "because I will destroy it first. It won't be easy because the house is very solid. The interior walls are made of brick. What I would do is this. I'd cut a large hole in the ceiling of each of the four corner rooms on the main floor, all the way through to the second floor. Then, I would put acetone in each of the cut-out holes and blow the place to bits. I've been assured I could demolish the entire house that way. In Georgia, arson is a crime only if it's done for the insurance. Mercer House is not insured. Danny's mother might get a nice piece of property, but there won't be a house on it." At the same time Jim Williams was calculating where to drill the holes in the floor of Mercer House, the Georgia Supreme Court was focusing its attention on a hole that was already there, the bullet hole in the bedroom floor upstairs. This was the hole allegedly made by Danny Hansford during his rampage through the house a month before he was killed. It was the hole about which the arresting officer, Corporal Anderson, had testified, "I couldn't determine if that was a fresh bullet hole or an old one." Seizing on that remark, Spencer Lawton had suggested that the bullet hole was an old one and that Williams had faked the incident to lay the groundwork for killing Hansford in self-defense a month later. Some weeks after the guilty verdict was handed down, Bobby Lee Cook received an envelope from an anonymous source in the district attorney's office. Inside was a copy of the police report written by Corporal Anderson on the night of the earlier incident. The report contained the statement, "We did find a fresh bullet hole in the floor." It contradicted his sworn testimony at the trial. The defense had obtained an edited copy of Anderson's written report by court order before the trial, but Lawton had whited out that particular line. When Bobby Lee Cook saw the complete text, he immediately realized that Lawton's excision amounted to prosecutorial misconduct. He made it the central argument in his appeal before the Georgia Supreme Court. The court responded angrily. It cited the patent inconsistency of Corporal Anderson's two statements about the bullet hole and denounced Lawton's attempt to cover it up. "We cannot and will not approve corruption of the truth-seeking function of the trial process," the unanimous ruling read. "Judgment reversed. A new trial must be ordered." Chapter 18. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. For all the commotion over the reversal of Jim Williams's conviction, the Georgia Supreme Court's ruling appeared to be little more than a temporary reprieve. The hole in the floor had been an unimportant detail in the trial. The main points of evidence in Spencer Lawton's case against Williams still remained intact. It seemed obvious that Williams would have to mount a stronger defense in his second trial, or the outcome would likely be another conviction. Williams was exultant nonetheless. He boasted that the reversal had vindicated him completely. He gloated that the wording of the ruling proved that Spencer Lawton and the police were liars. Williams dropped hints that indeed his defense would be stronger the second time around. "Things will be going my way from here on," he would say with a wink and a sly look. "Certain forces are at work." He deliberately left his listeners wondering whether he meant to say simply that public sympathy had shifted in his favor, or, more darkly, that the fix was in. One evening, Williams invited me to drop in at Mercer House. I found him sitting at his desk in his study, having a vodka and tonic. He regaled me with stories about two of his latest pet subjects, the corrupt Spencer Lawton and the biased and stupid Judge Oliver. Then, he came around to the subject of the mysterious forces working on his behalf.
"You know, I never had any doubt that the Supreme Court would throw out my conviction," he said. "I knew all along they'd do it. I was absolutely sure of it. Do you know why? Because I refused to allow myself even to think they'd reject my appeal. If I had thought about it, if I had dwelt on it, if I had become depressed and imagined the worst, then the worst would have happened." I could feel Williams watching me closely, weighing my reaction.
"Concentration," he went on, "that's what it was. Just like the little experiment I told you about at Duke University with the dice. I improved the odds in my case the same way the men at Duke did with the dice, the same way I do when I play my little game of psycho dice, through mental kinetics."
"You may think all this is nonsense," he went on. "Most people do, and all I can say to them is, fine, don't believe it, I'm not out to prove anything. But you're overlooking a valuable power available to anyone."
Williams smiled enigmatically, but I could tell he wasn't joking.
"Of course I've had help," he said. "I'm not the only person who's been concentrating on my behalf. I've had the assistance of someone very expert in these things. And I can tell you that when my second trial comes up, the judge, the DA, and whoever gets to sit on that jury will be at the receiving end of some very powerful vibrations."
Williams took a handful of dimes out of his pocket and put 9 of them in a neat stack on the desk blotter.
"I use the word vibrations for want of a better word," he said. "These vibrations, these thought waves, whatever you want to call them, will be generated by me and by a woman named Minerva. She's an old and very dear friend. She lives in Beaufort, South Carolina, about 45 minutes from here. I'm going to pay her a visit tonight."
Williams opened a drawer and took out a bottle of water.
"This is rainwater," he said. "Minerva told me to bring it with me tonight. She also told me to bring the dimes. These things will be coming into play later on tonight."
Williams looked up at me.
"If you're game, you're welcome to come along. It'll take 2 or 3 hours at most."
"Interested?"
"Sure, why not?" I said.
As soon as I had said it, I thought of a dozen reasons why not, but it was too late. Half an hour later, we went out through the back of Mercer House to the carriage house, where a green Jaguar sports car was parked on an oriental carpet. Williams set his vodka and tonic on the control panel and eased the car out into Wayne Street. In moments, we were gliding through the quiet streets of Savannah, up and over the Talmadge Bridge, and into the darkness of the South Carolina Lowcountry. The light from the dashboard cast a pale glow on Williams's face.
"If I told you that Minerva was a witch doctor, or a voodoo priestess, I'd be close," he said. "She's that and more. She was the common law wife of Dr. Buzzard, the last great voodoo practitioner in Beaufort County. Whether you know it or not, you're in the heart of voodoo country. This whole coastal area has been loaded with it since the slaves brought voodoo with them from Africa. Dr. Buzzard died a few years ago, and Minerva carries on his practice. For years, Dr. Buzzard was king of the Lowcountry root doctors. He was a commanding presence, tall, erect, and rail thin. He had a goatee, and he wore purple-tinted glasses. No one who ever saw those eyes staring through those purple lenses ever forgot them. He was especially effective defending clients in criminal cases. He'd sit in the courtroom and glare at hostile witnesses as he chewed the root. Sometimes they'd change their stories when they got on the stand and saw Dr. Buzzard staring at them. Either that or they'd just turn tail and run. Dr. Buzzard would focus his energies on the jury and the judge, too. I know a judge in Savannah who says he can tell when root workers are involved in a case, because his bench will be dressed down. He'll find roots and herbs and bones arranged all around it.
Dr. Buzzard made a good living. People would pay him to put curses on their enemies, or to remove a curse that their enemies had put on them. In some cases, he was paid by both parties. The money piled up. Dr. Buzzard built two big churches on St. Helena Island, and always drove around in big, flashy cars. He was quite a ladies' man, too, and in his last years, Minerva became his mistress. Williams took a sip from his drink, then set it back in its holder on the control panel. When Dr. Buzzard died, Minerva put on his purple glasses and set herself up as a root doctor. She uses some of his techniques and some of her own, too. She gets her special status and some of her spiritual powers by having direct access to Dr. Buzzard in perpetuity. She goes to his grave and calls on his spirit constantly. Williams said he did not himself believe in voodoo. I don't put much stock in the hocus-pocus part of it, the herbs and roots and powdered bones and frogs' tongues and all that. They're only props. But I do have respect for the spiritual force behind it. Minerva told me to bring 9 shiny dimes tonight and some fresh water that ain't run through no pipe. The dimes were easy, but her instructions about the water meant I either had to get it from a stream or find some rainwater. There happened to be rainwater in a basin in my courtyard. That's what's in the bottle. Would she know the difference if you had just filled it with tap water? I asked. Not from the look or the taste, he said, but she'd know in an instant, just by looking at my face. The town of Beaufort was dark and still. Williams drove along the main street, passing the great old houses that faced across the harbor towards Sea Islands, 18th-century mansions of brick, tabby, and wood. Halfway between Savannah and Charleston, Beaufort had once been a major shipping center, but it was now an almost forgotten, perfectly preserved, gem-like little village. We cruised along the narrow streets, passing rows of handsome white houses gleaming in the darkness. The tidy, well-manicured section of town gave way shortly to unpaved streets and tiny, run-down cottages. We pulled up in front of a wooden shanty with a swept sand front yard. The house was unpainted, except for the door and windows, which were a light blue. "Haint blue," said Williams. "It keeps the evil spirits out." The house was dark. Williams knocked lightly and then pushed the door open. The flickering light from a TV set was the only illumination in the cluttered front room. Pungent cooking smells of pork and greens filled the air. A man lay asleep on a daybed. He stirred as we entered. A young black woman came into the room through a curtained doorway, carrying a plate of food. She nodded toward the back of the house without saying a word, and we walked on through. Minerva was sitting in a small room under a bare light bulb. She was like a sack of flour. Her cotton dress was stretched tight over her round body. Her skin was a pale brown, and her face was as round as a tranquil moon. Her gray hair was pulled back in a bun, except for 2 little pigtails, one hanging over each ear. She wore a pair of purple-tinted, wire-rimmed glasses. The table in front of her was piled high with bottles, vials, twigs, boxes, and odd bits of cloth. The floor was littered with shopping bags, some bulging, some empty. When she saw Williams, she broke into a broad, gap-toothed smile and motioned for us to sit down on 2 folding chairs.
"I've been waiting on you, baby," she said in a half-whispered voice.
"Well, how've you been, Minerva?" Williams asked. Minerva's face clouded over.
"I've been dealing with a lot of graveyard dirt."
"Not again," said Williams. Minerva nodded.
"Mm-hmm. There's a lot of grudgefulness and deceitfulness."
Minerva spoke in a faraway voice.
It came from so deep within her that the words sounded as if they had been uttered eons ago on a distant planet and were just now reaching the earth through her.
"My son's ex-wife. She had 3 children with him. She'd drive by and throw graveyard dirt on my porch. I gets it by the bucketful. That's how come I be blocked a lot. Business gets poor. Then my boy gets in trouble with the police. I can't sleep. And I've been raising hell with my old man that's dead."
"Dr. Buzzard?"
"Yeah, him,"
said Minerva.
"I need to get me some money, and I've been playing the numbers so I can get some. I always go to him and I pay him a dime for him to give me a number, but he won't give me one for shit. I cuss he ass out. I don't know why he don't want me to get no money."
Minerva put aside a small wax doll she'd been working on.
"Well, it looks like we're back in business again, you and me, don't it?"
"Yes," said Williams. "Now we've got a second trial to work on."
"Yes, I know that."
Minerva leaned forward and brought her face close to Williams.
"He's working hard against you, baby."
"Who is?" Williams was startled. "Not Dr. Buzzard."
"No, no,"
Minerva said.
"The boy. The dead boy."
"Danny? Well, it doesn't surprise me. He planned this whole thing. He knew that I was getting tired of his damn games. He knew I had $25,000 in cash at the house that night because I was going to Europe on a buying trip. It was his big chance. He could kill me and take it." Minerva shook her head.
"That boy is working hard against you."
"Well, can you do something about it?"
"I can try,"
she said. "Good, because there's something else I want you to do, too," said Williams.
"What's that, baby?"
"I want you to put a curse on the district attorney."
"Well, of course. Tell me his name again."
"Spencer Lawton. L-A-W-T-O-N.
"Yeah, I worked his name before. Tell me what's going on with him since we got you off."
"He's desperate. He's been district attorney now for 2 years, and he's never won a case himself in court. He's mortified. People are laughing at him."
"They gonna keep on laughing. Did you bring them things like I told you to?"
Minerva asked.
"Yes," said Williams. "I did."
"Water that ain't run through no pipe?"
"Uh-huh."
"And did you put it in a quart jar, with no label on it and no metal cap?"
"Yes."
"And those 9 shiny dimes?"
"They're in my pocket."
"Okay, baby. Now I want you to sit down and do something for me."
Minerva gave Williams a quill pen and a bottle of red ink labeled Dove's Blood.
"Write Spencer Lawton's name on this piece of paper 7 times. Connect the 2 names as 1. Dot no I's and cross no T's. Now you do that while I do some work over here."
Minerva began filling a plastic shopping bag with odd items. 2 trowels, pieces of cloth, some bottles. Somewhere on the table, under all the piles of stuff, a telephone rang. Minerva dug out the receiver.
"Hello? Uh-huh. Okay, now listen to me."
She spoke in a half whisper.
"She want you back, but she want you running behind her, begging. Remember what I told you. Before you sleep with her again, put a tablespoon of honey in the bath and take a honey bath. After you have sex, dry yourself off with that piece of muslin cloth I gave you. Hang it up to dry. Do not wash it. Later on, wrap it around a purple onion and tie the corners with a square knot. Huh? I say a square knot. That knot I showed you. Two knots makes one. Okay. Then all you got to do is bury the cloth where she will walk over it or pass by. Uh-huh. Now, darling, don't you depend on her to give you too much money, 'cause she won't give you none. That's why her and her husband don't get along. Uh-uh, she ain't gonna be issuing out no money. And listen, be careful about your personal belongings. Your dirty socks, your dirty undershorts, your hair, pictures of your head. She might try to take them to someone like me. Put a picture of her in your wallet, in a secret place, between things, with her head upside down. Do that for me. Uh-huh. That's right. And let me know. Bye-bye.
Minerva looked across the table at Williams.
You done, baby?
Yes, he said.
Okay. Now you know how dead time works. Dead time lasts for 1 hour, from half an hour before midnight to half an hour after midnight. The half hour before midnight is for doing good. The half hour after midnight is for doing evil.
Right, said Williams.
Seems like we need a little of both tonight,
said Minerva.
So we best be on our way. Put the paper in your pocket where the dimes is and take your bottle of water. We go into the flower garden.
Minerva picked up her shopping bag and headed out the back door. We followed close behind as she made her way down the lane with a slow and ponderous stride. As she approached the next house, an old man got up from a chair on the porch and went inside. A window in another house closed. A door shut somewhere. Two men standing beside an oleander bush parted when they caught sight of Minerva and withdrew into the darkness. In a few moments, we reached the end of the lane. The sliver of a new moon hung like a slender cradle over a grove of tall, dark trees. We were at the edge of a graveyard. On the far side, 100 yards beyond the trees, a floodlit basketball court cast a pale gray light into the graveyard. A boy was bouncing a ball and taking shots at the basketball hoop. Thunk, 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 proing. Otherwise, the graveyard was deserted.
A lot of people does this kind of work,
Minerva said.
But it looked like we got the garden all to ourselves tonight.
We walked single file into the graveyard, taking a winding route and stopping finally at a grave under a large cedar tree. My first thought was that this was a new grave, because unlike the others, the soil appeared to be freshly spread on top of it. Minerva knelt by the headstone. She reached into the shopping bag and gave Williams a trowel.
Go to the other end and dig a hole 4 inches deep with this spade,
she said.
Drop one of the dimes into it and cover it up.
Williams did as she said. The earth came up with no effort at all. The grave had clearly been dug into and churned so often that the soil was as loose as sand in a sandbox. I stood a few yards back and watched. Minerva and Williams were like two people kneeling at the opposite ends of a picnic blanket. They faced each other over the bones of Dr. Buzzard.
Now's the time for doing good,
said Minerva.
First, we gotta get that boy to ease off a little. Tell me something about him.
He tried to kill me, said Williams.
I know that. Tell me something before that.
Well, Williams cleared his throat. Danny was always getting into fights. He got mad at his landlord once and threw a chair through the man's window. Then he went outside and tore up his car with a brick. Another time he got angry at an exterminator who'd been hired to spray his apartment, so he punched him in the eye, banged his head on the pavement, and then later, after the man had sworn out a police warrant against him,
took a baseball bat and chased him around Madison Square, screaming that he was going to kill him. He bragged to me once that he'd fired 5 shots from a pistol at some guy on a motorcycle because the guy was trying to date the same barmaid Danny was seeing at the time. One bullet hit the guy in the foot. His mother had to get police protection from him. She took out a peace warrant against him, which meant if he came within 50 feet of her, he'd be arrested. Minerva wrapped her arms around herself and shivered.
"It ain't doing no good," she said. "That boy is still working hard against you."
She thought for a moment.
"Tell me something good he done."
"I can't think of anything," said Williams.
"All he ever done was bad things? What made him happy?"
"His Camaro," said Williams. "He loved that Camaro. He used to zoom around in it and see how many wheels he could get off the ground at once. If he turned a corner real fast, he could usually get 2 wheels in the air. When he drove out to Tybee, he liked to shoot up over that bump in the road leading onto the Lazaretto Creek Bridge, because if he hit it just right, he could get all 4 wheels off the ground at the same time. He loved doing that. He wouldn't let anybody touch that car. It was his pride and joy. He painted it with a spray can, flat black, just the way he wanted it. He'd spend hours fixing it and cleaning it and painting those racing stripes on it. And he was very good at that, painting those stripes and the little curlicues. He was very creative. That's something most people didn't understand about Danny. He was an artist. He flunked every subject in school but art. He always got an A in art. Of course, his talent wasn't developed. He didn't have the patience. I have a couple of his paintings. They're full of fantasy and they're wild, but you can see he had talent. I used to tell him, "Danny, do something with this. You're good at it." But he could never apply himself to anything. He never got past the 8th grade, but he was quick-witted and bright. One time, I paid him to dismantle 2 crystal chandeliers at Mercer House and clean them. When he was just about finished reassembling them, I noticed he'd attached all the little prisms backwards. There were hundreds of them. I explained that each of the prisms was like a diamond ring, and that the flat surface had to face out and the pointed surface had to face inward, otherwise it wouldn't sparkle. I told him he'd have to take them all off and put them back on the right way. I said I'd pay him for the extra time it took. Well, he looked at that chandelier. He looked at it real long like it was a rattlesnake. Then he climbed down from the ladder and said, "The hell with it. I'm out of here. I ain't serving no prism sentence." I laughed at his pun. I thought it was delightful. He turned around and stormed out of the house, but I could see the corner of his mouth was turned up in a little grin. It pleased him that I'd laughed at his joke. Minerva smiled.
"I felt him backing off a little," she said.
"What do you mean?" asked Williams.
"I felt it just as you were saying those things about him. I felt that boy ease up some."
"Why do you suppose that happened?" Williams asked.
"He heard you say you loved him,"
Minerva said.
"What? But that's... he tried to kill me."
"I knew he was working against you, baby, and now I know what he was trying to do. He was trying to make you hate him. He wants you to show the world you hate him. That way, they'll think you hated him bad enough to kill him in cold blood. If you do that, you will surely go to jail, and he knows it."
"I have every right to hate him," said Williams. "He tried to kill me."
"And he paid a heavy price for it. Now he's trying to make you pay a heavy price, too."
Minerva turned her shopping bag upside down and hurriedly spread its contents in front of her.
"We ain't got time to argue. That was the opening I was looking for. Now I can get to work. Quick, we ain't got much time left. It must be nearing midnight. Dig another hole and put another dime in it, and this time think about that boy's Camaro. Come on, do it. Think about them pretty stripes the boy painted on it and how good he done it.
William silently dug another hole and dropped another dime in. Minerva dug a hole at her end and slipped a root into it. Then she covered it up and sprinkled it with a white powder.
Now dig another hole, and this time think about that boy's two paintings you got. Think how good they was. We trying to keep him off your case. He's backing off. Oh, he's backing off. I feel it.
Minerva took a twig and poked it into the ground several times, mumbling and chanting as she did. She sprinkled some more powder and then drew a circle in the dirt.
You through, baby? Now do it another time and think about that prism sentence. Think how it made you laugh, and think how your laughing made the boy smile. Do that for me.
Minerva continued her ministrations over the head of Dr. Buzzard, while down at the old man's feet, William silently dug yet another hole.
Now do it one more time,
said Minerva.
And this time, drop the rest of the dimes into the hole and think about all them things together. And think about anything else that was good about that boy that maybe you ain't told me yet.
Minerva watched as Williams followed her instructions.
Now take that bottle and pour a little water on each of the covered-up holes so your kindly thoughts about that boy will take root and flower and come back to bless you.
Minerva closed her eyes and sat in silence for several minutes. A church bell began to chime the hour of midnight. She opened her eyes again and quickly picked up a pink plastic purse. She scooped a trowel of dirt into it.
Graveyard dirt works best when it come from a grave right at midnight, she said. This ain't for your job, though, baby. This is for my private use.
She sighed.
Black magic never stops. What goes from you comes to you. Once you start this shit, you gotta keep it up. Just like the utility bill. Just like the grocery store or they kill you. You got to keep it up. 2, 5, 10, 20 years.
The purse was now bulging with dirt. She put it back into her shopping bag.
It's after midnight now,
she said.
Time for doing evil. I'm gonna work on the DA. He's a man, so I will cross-sex with him and go to 9 different dead women. 9. I will call them 3 times. I can't guarantee they will all be in your favor, but somewhere down the line there will be an opening, and the dead will settle with him the way they did the last time. Take that piece of paper out of your pocket, the one with his name written on it, and lay it flat on the ground with the writing up.
Williams did as he was told.
Now fold the paper over once, and then fold it again. Then put it back in your pocket. Okay. Now you just sit quiet while I call on the dead.
Minerva spoke unintelligible words in her dreamy, half-whispered voice. All I could make out were the names of the dead women. Viola, Cassandra, Serenity, Larcinia, Delia. Minerva used every prop she had brought with her. Roots, charms, powders, squares of cloth. She put them on the ground in front of her and stirred them with 2 sticks as if mixing a voodoo salad. Then, one by one, she put all the items back into her shopping bag. When this was done, she looked at Williams.
Walk to the edge of the graveyard and wait for me there, she said. And don't look back. I got some more work to do here.
Williams and I walked away. After a few steps, I ducked behind an oak tree where I could still see Minerva. She began to mutter, Her muttering became moans. The moans turned into wailing, and the wailing grew louder and louder. Minerva's arms fluttered and wheeled like small propellers. When she was finally out of breath, her hands fell to her lap. She bowed her head in silence for a moment. The only sound in the graveyard was the thunk, thunk, thunk of the basketball bouncing in the distance. At length, Minerva spoke in an urgent whisper.
"Listen to me, old man. Why you doing me this way? Tell me why. I give you dimes and ask for a number, but you won't give me one for shit. You lay there night after night just laughing at me. Didn't I do right by you? Didn't I wait for you in the bed when you was old and tired and your teeth was rotten? Damn it, listen to me."
Minerva poked the ground with her trowel.
"Give me a damn number. Give it to me."
She poked the ground again.
"I ain't giving you no peace, old man, till you give me a number. Look at me having to wear this nasty dress. I need to buy me a new one. The roof is leaking. The boy's in trouble with the police. I gets graveyard dirt on my porch. I be blocked. Business gets poor."
With each complaint, Minerva jabbed the ground in the vicinity of Dr. Buzzard's ribs. Finally, she dropped the trowel into her shopping bag and pulled herself to her feet with a sigh. I slipped away and joined Williams at the edge of the graveyard. Moments later, Minerva approached us, muttering.
"Stubborn old man," she said. "I cuss he ass, but he still won't give me a number."
"Haven't you won that damn numbers game by now, Minerva?" Williams asked.
"Yes, I won it,"
she said.
"One time I put $36 on 333, and that was the number."
"How much did you win?"
"I should have won $10,000, but I didn't get one dime."
"Why not?"
"The bookie changed the number."
"How could you let him get away with that?"
"He didn't get away with nothing, baby. I fixed it so he don't work no more. I went to the garden and gave him back his kindness. Now he's sickly, and we got us a new bookie."
As we walked up the lane from the graveyard, Minerva gave Williams his parting instructions. He was to put the paper with Spencer Lawton's name on it into a jar filled with water that had not run through any pipe. He was to place the jar in the darkness of his closet, where it wouldn't be touched by the light of the sun or the glow of the moon until the trial was over. He was to cut a photograph of Lawton's face out of the newspaper, black out his eyes with a pen, first the right eye, then the left, draw 9 lines across his lips as if sewing him up, put the photograph in his coat pocket, and make sure a preacher touched his coat. Afterward, he was to burn the photograph in the exact spot where Danny Hansford had died.
"Do that," said Minerva, "and Spencer Lawton will lose your case. But you must do one more thing, too. Once a day, every day, you must close your eyes and tell that boy you forgive him for what he done to you. And deep in your heart, you must truly forgive him. You hear?"
"I hear," said Williams. Minerva stopped at a turnoff to another road.
"Now you go on back to Savannah and do like I say," she said.
"Aren't you going home?"
Williams asked. Minerva patted her shopping bag.
"Baby, I never takes graveyard dirt into my own house. I'll deliver it first, and I must do that alone."
Williams was silent as we began the drive back. "Are you going to follow Minerva's instructions about Spencer Lawton's picture?" I asked.
"I might," said Williams. "It's a little corny, but it could end up being good therapy. Sewing up his mouth, blacking out his eyes. Yes, that's something I might be able to get into."
How about the daily message of forgiveness to Danny Hansford? Are you going to do that too?
Definitely not, he said. Danny was nothing but a would-be murderer.
Williams picked up his glass and drank what was left of his vodka and tonic.
My case has come down to one thing and one thing only, he said. Money. Danny knew I had $25,000 in cash in the house. When my lawyer, Bob Duffy, arrived at Mercer House that night, he walked around inspecting the merchandise, picking up little objects and turning them bottom side up. When I asked him what he was going to charge to represent me, he said 50 big ones. Later, when I realized I needed a good criminal lawyer, I hired Bobby Lee Cook. Bobby Lee brought his wife to the house, and she picked out $50,000 worth of antiques. That was his fee. His expenses were in addition to that. He was assisted by John Wright Jones, who got $20,000. And now I will have to pay all over again for another trial. But Danny's mother takes the prize with her $10 million lawsuit against me. After all the anguish and grief Danny had caused her, after she'd thrown him out of the house and gotten police protection from him, Danny was suddenly her beloved dead son, miraculously transformed from a dangerous liability into an asset worth $10 million. Lord knows what it'll cost me to defend myself against her lawsuit. So you see, it's all about money. And that's one of the reasons I love Minerva. You can laugh at that voodoo stuff if you want, but she only charged me $25 tonight. I don't know whether or not you got her point. But no matter how you look at it, she's a bargain.
I didn't answer, but it occurred to me that, yes, I did get Minerva's point. I got her point very clearly. What I wondered was, did Williams? Chapter 19. Lafayette Square, we are here. Glass in hand, Joe Odom stood on the roof of his new home and looked down at the floats and the marching bands passing through Lafayette Square below. It was a perfect spot for watching the St. Patrick's Day parade. From the rooftop, Joe could see green-tinted water bubbling out of the fountain in the center of the square. He could see crowds lining the streets wearing green hats and carrying big paper cups full of green beer. St. Patrick's Day in Savannah was the equivalent of Mardi Gras in New Orleans. It was an official holiday. The whole town turned out for it. There were to be more than 200 marching units today, plus 40 bands and 30 floats. A cheer rose up from the crowd as the Anheuser-Busch team of 8 shaggy-hoofed Clydesdale horses trotted around the square, past the front of the house. Like most St. Patrick's Day parades, Savannah's was an ecumenical affair. Blacks, Scots, and Germans marched along with the Irish, but this parade had a distinctly southern flavor. At one point, that flavor took a bitter turn. A column of marchers dressed in gray Confederate uniforms came into the square, with a horse-drawn wagon bringing up the rear. The wagon had low wooden sides, and from the street it would have appeared empty. But from the roof, we could see a blue-clad Union soldier sprawled motionless on the floor of the wagon. It was a chilling tableau, the more so because it was meant to be surreptitious.
"Poor damn Yankee," said Joe. "Look at him down there, all bloody and dead."
"The Civil War's been over quite a while," I said. "Isn't it time all that was forgotten?"
"Not if you're a Southerner," said Joe.
"But you know, that dead Yankee isn't just about the Civil War. He's sort of a symbol of what could happen to any Yankee, even a modern-day Yankee, who comes down here and gets folks all riled up."
Joe looked at me and lifted his glass in tribute. "He could be some fella from New York who decided to write a book about us and started filling it with drag queens and murderers and corpses and bottles of poison and..." What's that you were telling me about just a minute ago? Oh, yeah, voodoo. Voodoo. Witchcraft in a graveyard. Damn. I'm not making any of this up, Joe, I said. I'm not saying you are. So I take it you don't really disapprove. No. As a matter of fact, when I think about it, it suits me fine. See, with all these weirdos you got filling up your book, I figure somebody's going to have to play the good guy, and it's beginning to look like it'll be me. Joe Odom's new residence was by far the grandest of the four he had occupied in the short time I'd known him. It was an ornate four-story mansion, a Second Empire chateau, built by a former mayor of Savannah in 1873. It was the only house of its kind in Savannah, and it stood out. People often referred to it as the Charles Adams House, because it had a mansard roof topped by a lacy ironwork cresting. The Hamilton Turner House was its proper name, and it was so fine an example of its type that it was featured in a field guide to American houses. Tall, paired windows opened onto elegant balconies, and a cast-iron picket fence embraced the site. All in all, the Hamilton Turner House was so imposing and yet so fanciful a structure that passers-by often stopped in front of it for no other reason than to marvel at it. Joe was not one to let such an opportunity slip through his fingers. He posted a sign on the gate a few days after he moved in. Private residence. Tours 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Knowledgeable Savannians were taken aback by the sign, because they knew that the outside of the Hamilton Turner House was the only part worth looking at. The interior had been gutted and cut up into apartments long ago. Joe had taken the parlor floor for himself, and it was only this portion of the house that was open for viewing. The space did have tall windows with dramatic views of the square, but the once stately progression of beautifully proportioned rooms had been sacrificed to make bathrooms, bedrooms, closets, and a kitchen. Walls had been moved and open archways filled in. And yet, because of its vastness, the parlor floor still did retain the aura of a grand piano nobile. It had old chandeliers and mantels and pier mirrors, though none were original to the house, and Joe did manage to fill the place appealingly with what was left of his own furniture, plus antiques borrowed from friends or taken on consignment from local antique shops. Joe had, in fact, created something new in Savannah, the only private house that was operating as a full-time tourist attraction. Seven other houses were also open to the public, but they were all museum houses, all important architectural specimens authentically restored and staffed by professional curators and operated on a non-profit basis. Joe's made-over parlor floor had, in effect, gone into competition with the museums. And he did get his share of tourists. At least 50 people would walk in off the street every day, and half a dozen or more tour buses would stop by. One busload usually stayed for lunch, and in the evenings, Joe made the dining room available for private dinners by candlelight. To help handle all this traffic, Joe hired a short, indomitably cheerful black housekeeper and stationed her at the top of the front steps in a crisp black-and-white maid's uniform. Her name was Gloria, and she had big eyes and little corkscrew curls hanging down over her forehead. Knowing that half the money she collected at the door was hers to keep, Gloria flagged down virtually everybody who came near the house. On slow days, she was not above offering a cut-rate deal, $1 per person instead of the usual $3. "It may only be but a dollar," she would say later, "but it sure looks like a lot sitting next to nothing." Gloria gave her customers a glass of lemonade and led them through the parlor floor, blinking her eyes in wonderment as she recounted the historical highlights of the house. She explained that it was the first house in Savannah to be electrified, the mayor who built it had also been head of the power company, and that it had served as the center of the city's social and cultural life in the latter part of the 19th century. "This house is the center of a lot of things now, too," she would add with a big smile. If Mr. Joe happened to be home, he'd play a few old standards for the guests,
and then Gloria would sing the few lines she knew from Stormy Weather while doing a dance that resembled the hula. Joe netted an average of $500 a week from the house, most of it in cash, which suited his needs perfectly, since there wasn't a single bank left in Savannah that would give him a checking account. Even the bank account at Sweet Georgia Brown's had been taken out of his hands. It was now in Mandy's name, and it was her signature, not his, that appeared on all the checks made out to employees and suppliers of the bar. Joe and Mandy were no closer to marrying. In fact, his attentions toward other women had become more frequent and more open. On several occasions, Gloria found the door to Joe's bedroom locked while she was leading tours through the house. She was never at a loss for words. "Beyond this door lies the mansion's master bedroom," she would say, "and today the editors of Southern Accents magazine are photographing it for publication, and we cannot disturb them. So I'm very sorry, but we will not be able to see this room today." Her explanation might or might not be thrown into question by the sounds of laughter and giggling on the other side of the door. Mandy was aware of Joe's flirtations.
"I swear Joe Odom is going to drive me into being a feminist," she said. "2 years ago, if anybody had told me that, I'd have died."
But Mandy began to display a new assertiveness. She snatched up the checkbook at Sweet Georgia Brown's and stationed herself at the cash register, thereby shutting off Joe's supply of easy money. So the cash flowing into Joe's pocket from the tour business provided a much-needed lifeline. But there was a hitch. It was illegal. The Hamilton Turner House was zoned for residential use. Private tour houses were not permitted. Lafayette Square was a quiet, conservative corner of Savannah. It was surrounded by stately townhouses and freestanding mansions. The townhouse where the writer Flannery O'Connor had lived as a child stood catty-corner from Joe on Charlton Street. Directly across the square, the magnificent Andrew Lowe House, a pink Italianate villa with a Greek Revival portico, sat in all its architectural and historical splendor. Juliet Gordon Lowe had founded the Girl Scouts of America there in 1912, and it was now the Georgia headquarters of the Colonial Dames. Of all Joe's neighbors, however, none was more reproachful a presence than the Lafayette Apartment House, that monument to Joe's financial debacle of just a few years back. The Lafayette stood on the far side of the square in silent rebuke to Joe. Within its walls there were half a dozen people who had still not recovered from the shock of having their apartments foreclosed and then having to sue to get them back when Joe defaulted on his construction loan. The noise and the fumes of the buses irritated the residents of Lafayette Square, but the wedding parties nearly drove them to distraction. For these affairs, Joe literally annexed the square as his own front yard. He put a Dixieland band on the portico over his front door and pitched tents in the square without bothering to obtain a permit. The square reverberated with blaring music and the shrill chatter of 100 wedding guests milling about.
"Everybody loves a wedding,"
said Joe, grievously miscalculating the tolerance of his neighbors. After enduring 3 such weddings, the neighbors formed a committee and sent a spy into the Hamilton Turner House on a fact-finding mission. The spy was a dowdy middle-aged woman who lived on the south side. Posing as a walk-in tourist, she entered the Hamilton Turner House at 3 in the afternoon for what was supposed to have been a 20-minute tour. She emerged 2 hours later with her hair frosted and spiked and her face made up to look like Cleopatra. She declared that Joe Odom was a heartthrob, that the housekeeper Gloria was so cute she could just eat her up, and that she didn't have time to discuss it any further because she needed to rush home, change clothes, and get to Sweet Georgia Brown's in time for happy hour. Exasperated, the committee selected a second spy, also a middle-aged woman, but this one was a bit more savvy, having been a docent in one of the museum houses. This second spy came back to report that there was a lot more going on in the Hamilton Turner House than tours. Joe Odom, charming as he is, seems unable to distinguish between his private and his business lives. His many friends pop in and out and mingle with the paying guests in a most familiar way. They converse, they make drinks, they raid the refrigerator, they use the telephone. Four men were playing poker in the dining room, and I could swear I saw one of them on the evening news not long ago. He's very fat, that's why I remember him, and he'd been arrested for embezzlement, or maybe it was drug running. There was a woman curled up on a sofa, sleeping off what Mr. Odom laughingly described as a marathon binge. In the kitchen, we came upon an extremely talkative young man giving an elderly woman a permanent wave. He had the cheek to suggest that I should be next, that I could use a comb out, I think it was. When you add to these activities the constant comings and goings of the tenants who live in the upstairs apartments, they must all walk through Mr. Odom's entrance hall to reach the stairway, you have an idea of the chaotic atmosphere that prevails. Mr. Odom's tours are an out-and-out con job, the spy went on. $3 is a lot to pay for a glimpse of a thrown-together apartment with no historic interest. Most of Mr. Odom's artifacts are bogus, General Oglethorpe's snuff box and that sort of thing. Often, Mr. Odom simply lapses into a parody of a real house tour. He referred to a pair of oil portraits as his ancestors by purchase, because he said he'd found them in a flea market and they seemed to want to come home with him. The furniture is an ungainly combination of styles, some reproductions, some period pieces, almost all of it in deplorable condition. One love seat had an overturned slop bucket in place of a missing leg. Knowing of Mr. Odom's precarious financial situation, I was not surprised that he made several allusions to the fact that everything in the house was for sale. Carpets, paintings, furniture, bric-a-brac. He sang a few songs, which was pleasant enough, but then he made a blatant pitch for Sweet Georgia Brown's, flyers for which lie in stacks on every table. It seems clear that this whole tawdry enterprise is nothing but a promotional come-on for Mr. Odom's nightclub. By contrast, the museum houses give far greater educational value, and the fees they collect are used for the worthwhile purpose of maintaining important remnants of Savannah's heritage. Mr. Odom's tours merely cheapen the concept. Shortly after this visitation, the Department of Inspections notified Joe by certified letter that the tour business at the Hamilton Turner House violated the zoning code and must cease immediately. Joe ignored the order.
"The best response is always no response," he said. "It buys you 2 or 3 months breathing time, 6 if you're lucky."
In the meantime, he quietly persuaded friends on the Metropolitan Planning Commission to propose a zoning amendment allowing private tour houses. When the Downtown Neighborhood Association got wind of it, they voted to oppose it, and the amendment went down to defeat. A few weeks later, the day before the St. Patrick's Day parade, the Department of Inspections again ordered Joe to stop the tours at once or face legal action. This time, the Savannah Morning News picked up the story. Joe's breathing time, it seemed, was over. The wagon carrying the dead Union soldier turned the corner and continued up Abercorn Street.
"I don't know, Joe," I said. "I get the feeling you might end up in that wagon before I do."
"Nah, don't you start fretting about your friend Joe," he said.
"You're going to obey the court order, aren't you?"
"Me? The host of Savannah close my doors? It's not my nature to be antisocial. Goes against my grain. Besides, I'm getting filthy rich being so hospitable. I'd have to be crazy to become unfriendly all of a sudden."
Joe looked out over the square, scanning the buildings ranged around him as if they were enemy fortifications.
"I have a plan."
"What is it?"
"I thought I'd enlist the help of some of your new friends. That Minerva woman, for instance. I thought we might drive over to Beaufort around midnight and have a little chat with her. See if she'll cast a spell on some of the folks who want to shut me down. Or maybe we could get your buddy Luther Driggers to poison 'em. Or your pal Jim Williams to shoot 'em,
in self-defense, of course. Poor taste, I said. No good, huh? Well, I have another idea. I really do, and this one is serious. Come on downstairs. I'll show you what I mean. Joe